When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Hello and welcome
fails.
To When Diplomacy Fails.
A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 years war.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War I.
The Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluges.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916.
To the Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails Remastered.
Alrighty, welcome to, well, the penultimate remastered talk episode, guys. Thanks for joining us for all of these remastered episodes, and I hope that if you've never heard this talk episode before, then you'll give it a listen and see what you thought about Zach and Sean's, well, different look at the Boer War. It was a good time, a very good time, and actually, I remember finishing this and thinking, yeah, I'm kind of happy with that, which is always, obviously, a good feeling to have. These days, I get that feeling occasionally, but there you go. That's another issue. Have a good time listening to this. Just two friends shooting the breeze over history. Enjoy it, guys. Let me know what you thought through the usual channels. And remember, back then I thought that Uitlanders was pronounced Jutlanders. I apologize. Don't kill me. Thanks and enjoy. Back on the podcast, my guest as always is Sean. Say hello, Sean.
Hi, guys. How are you? If you said I'm fine, that there's something wrong with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you thought a response.
Yeah, if you thought a response, that's just...
The men in white coats will come for you.
Yeah, but you will freak the person out that's sitting beside you, so...
You might even scare the pigeons away.
Those pigeons is freaked out right now.
Okay, so... we're doing another talk episode right after the last one because we got such rave reviews, actually. We really did. People were very, very impressed. In fact, I think that was probably the best talk episode we've ever done. It went down very well, and we really did enjoy doing it, and it was very easy to edit as well, because...
Yeah, even though it doesn't look like it from the video. Yeah. Like, the video is terrible.
Yeah. So it went very well, and I suppose we better start the way we start all the other episodes that we do, where we shamelessly advertise for the first five minutes.
5 minutes of advertising.
So without any further ado...
Yeah! Let's be fit!
Yeah, let's be fit. Okay, so B is for blog... wdfpodcast.blogspot.ie.
Is
for email, where you can talk to me directly, which everyone obviously wants to do.
How many emails have you got?
Oh, very many. I've actually gotten far more junk emails.
Have you lost count?
I have actually lost count.
Oh, there you go, folks.
Yeah,
that
just shows how famous I am.
Proper hero.
You can email me directly, wdfpodcast@hotmail.com. F is for Facebook, where you can like the Facebook page, which you should definitely do,
definitely
because...
Do it.
It's doing very, very well, and every time I post up the new episode, or news, I'll always give you a special image that you could find easily by yourself, but why do that when you can
when
just get it from the page?
Facebook.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's also the option of joining the Facebook group, which you should definitely do.
Oh yeah, the podcasters.
Yeah, the History Podcasters, it's called, in capital letters. Search for it in the groups part of Facebook, and open your mind to a fantastic new world that is growing more and more every day.
So many guys there, and it's like really high quality stuff.
Very high quality, very good stuff as well.
Yeah.
Some genuine geniuses that I won't tell you so, but really, by their work, you can tell that they are. I is for iTunes. Would
be
embarrassing
really
if I really forgot.
Oh my god!
I know.
Okay, I is for iTunes,
where you can rate
the podcast.
And review it.
And review it.
Reviewing is really important.
Yes, reviewing is important because it makes it shoot up the rankings, which is always very nice to see, of
course.
But
don't worry, Ireland. You guys have done us proud. We're still number one.
Yeah, still number one in the What's Hot part.
Yeah.
And we actually do have a good few reviews in comparison, like in relation to the population. Australia, on the other hand, you guys are third in the downloads. Only one review. Very disappointing. Very sad.
And we have so many inner sisters over there.
Yeah, we should really...
It's probably your sister who did.
Yeah, probably that's
and,
the
yeah.
that's the review from my sister. Hugh, we should hue like some generic Australian joke now that stereotypes them and turns everyone off the podcast.
Yeah.
That'll be a smart move, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, what was that one on the history? You better watch the History Podcasters page.
Yeah.
Because they have a stern loving for the Australians and New Zealanders.
Yeah. Take that.
Yeah. They
okay.
love you too much.
Yeah. T is for tell a friend. Well, not even tell a friend. Tell people that aren't your friends. Tell people.
Tell your worst enemy.
Yeah.
You know.
And he'll consider it a gift to be told
and, yeah.
about the podcast.
And
that
you know,
he'll...
You'll bridge the gap and
yes,
you'll be friends.
You will. You'll be friends.
Or, you know, when you say you wouldn't wish it upon your worst enemy, you would wish this, because this is, you know, just bad enough that it wouldn't be terrible.
Yeah, I'm going to take that as a compliment. I think. So tell anyone, tell everyone about the podcast.
Tell
and
your grandmother. Tell your niece.
I think
tell your uncle's
yeah.
dog. Do everything.
Yeah.
Like, literally. Fanfares.
Yeah. Mm.
Ticket
start,
paper parade.
Start a fan page for When Diplomacy Fails,
yeah.
even though there's already
and
one
And have
there.
A cult of Zach Twomley.
Yes.
Have the cult of Zach Twomley.
Yeah.
They call him the Master. They actually do.
They call me the Master.
They actually call him the Master.
But that's only my first name. okay, so having said that then, we will move on to the first part of the discussion, talk episode.
Jeez, we're doing a really good job not messing up.
Yeah, we messed up like three times.
Yeah,
time.
You know.
Okay, so we will start with concentration camps, because this was
yeah,
the part
this
that
is
I...
something that he touched on and he didn't want to stick around.
Yeah.
It was already like a 53-minute
yeah,
podcast.
Yeah, and
so.
I don't like them going into an hour. Like, I think
yeah.
that's when you call it a night, when it's that far. And also, Chrono Minds was about to be on. And
yeah, and it's really important. You got to get your
yeah,
seasons in.
Exactly. I am a fan of Spencer Reid, so I have to get my daily dose right there.
Yeah.
But, okay, so
concentration camps. Not invented by the Germans.
Not
as
invented by the Germans.
Popular belief.
Yeah, as is popular belief. Or people who know that the Germans didn't invent them think that the Russians invented them with the gulags. But in actual fact, it was the British who, well, I'm not going to say invented them.
No, but used
were the
them
certainly were the first to use them on a widespread scale.
Yeah, for civilians. Like.
Yeah, for civilians as well. It wasn't just like...
It wasn't POWs.
When you think of concentration camps in the Boer War, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
I don't know. Shacks.
Yeah, shacks. Well, even like from the sources that I've looked at,
okay.
which have been a few books and stuff about
yeah.
it, there's actually... can't remember the guy's name, but I was thinking of including him in the actual podcast because he wrote a book just on concentration camps during the Boer War, but I didn't really have time to include him in the end. But basically, the conditions in the camps were absolutely horrendous. Not surprising. It wasn't just... when you think of civilians, though, you often just think of men, but because the British were so serious about the conflict and because they were so eager to wrap the whole thing up, they didn't just escort men into the camps. They sent women and children and anyone at all, really. And the old and the sick and the too young, they were... It's not that they were worked to death, but that they just weren't given enough to do.
So they were also work camps a lot?
Well, there was a few work camps,
okay.
but it, for the mainstay, it was just we put the people
here...
Were
the work camps being used to build those bunkers, the little pill houses or whatever?
The block houses?
Yeah.
No, not so much. That
okay.
was that was more
that was just
for...
slave labour.
Yeah, well, it
okay.
wasn't so much slave labour as just, like, they got coloured workers to do it, but because
right.
there were so many of them everywhere, it was easier to do it like that. And later
yeah.
on, they'd actually arm them, but not so much. But in the concentration camps that were mostly used, that you mostly see, it was more a case of let's get everyone that we can and put them in here so that they're not a bother to us. But instead of actually treating them with respect when they were all herded together, it was more a case of, okay, they're out of sight and out of mind kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely
yeah.
awful when you think about
nice.
These are actual people who have lived there their you know, their entire known lives.
Yeah, like they're probably third generation immigrants.
Yeah, and it because the Boer War is often seen, it's the last Victorian war because during this war, Queen Victoria dies. But it's often seen as a kind of a clean war for those that don't know enough about it, because World War One was so awful and because the Crimea, so many people died in it,
yeah,
that, like, of disease and everything else. But in actual fact, the Boer War is just as bad if you consider the fact that there was concentration camps.
Yeah, and, like, probably worse, because this wasn't even, like, it was absolutely discrimination, like, exactly like Hitler was, except nobody remembers it. No one's like, oh
no,
my goodness.
There's not enough awareness,
because it has been so far away from Europe. Mm. The Europeans seem really casual about it, and it was a big deal. Like,
it was a very big deal, and civilians, over 26,000 died, like actually died.
Goodness.
And that's the majority of them were women and children. The Boers who fought the British, when they actually came back into civilian life, so many of them, their lives have been destroyed and their families have been destroyed, that they moved back home to the Netherlands, which we'll get into a bit later on. But they moved back home to Europe. They emigrated to the United States and everything else.
That's terrible.
And often they actually came, they often themselves came into positions of power. An interesting side note, a few of them who went back to the Netherlands and who went back to the United States came into political positions of power, whereby they were able to then influence the politics of the state, obviously not to a really a large degree, but enough to create an anti-British sentiment in those areas.
Yeah.
Like, even the, I can't remember his name, but one of the American ambassador to Britain was a descendant of the Boers, and because of that, he held plenty of anti-British sentiments, and this meant that when it came time for World War II, because this was a bit later on, when it came time for World War II, he was very anti-British himself. And actually expected the downfall of the country.
I mean, a lot of countries in the history, as the passage of time has gone on, have been ticked off by the British.
Yeah.
So there is just a general sense in all of Britain's colonies that
nothing against,
like,
England.
Yeah, and it's only really in sport.
We
do like you English guys.
Well, it's only because, like, all the Irish can really win in is, like, in terms of sport, is like rugby and sometimes cricket.
Yeah,
if we're given a chance.
Cricket, yeah.
Sometimes
and probably not hockey, but
no.
You don't play us in hurling. Like, if you played us in hurling, we'd definitely beat you.
Didn't, like, some random African team or something beat us in hurling one time?
Well, maybe we just didn't send Kerry after them.
Anyway, we're getting off the topic. I want to move on from the subject of concentration camps.
Yeah, to the Irish.
Yeah,
stuff.
I want to move,
like,
to the Irish
that
experience.
That was a good link.
It was pretty good, I suppose.
Yeah.
Could have been worse.
Could have been better.
Irish. What is it that you? Because I like to include you in the discussions.
You can do this all by yourself.
That wouldn't make it nearly as special. I want to just ask, like, what is it that you? What do you know about the Irish?
The only thing I really remember was the Connacht Rangers or something like that.
Mm.
There's this painting of these guys walking, like, basically across the wilderness in their red coats, but they're Irish and they've got this kid in the foreground. I don't know exactly where it is or what it is. But something to do with Connacht, and it was like, it really, to me, that picture just it summarized that it was the last time the Irish were really for the British. Like, we fought with them and we didn't turn around and do a rebellion at the same time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. The Irish experience during this war, it's very interesting, because in the Crimea, I didn't get into this before, but Queen Victoria during the Crimean War was so impressed with the bravery of the Irish unit there that they were allowed to wear the shamrock, the Irish units wear. And this was considered a big deal because the shamrock wasn't allowed to be worn because it was a symbol of, like, Irish
republicanism.
Yeah, and it was a symbol of their nationality as well, which they were trying to cover up.
They were trying to make us British and
yeah.
we were trying to remain Irish.
But during this time, during the early 1900s, late 1800s, there is a big revival in Irish nationalism, and it's seen very clearly through the Boer War. There was, in fact, two Boer commando units made exclusively of Irish immigrants, Irish men, who would come over during the population boom of the gold rush and of the diamond rush.
Yeah.
But instead of fighting on the side against the Boers, they fought on the side with the Boers. And which is interesting, because if you look
now
at
now I'm confused. Did you mean against, as in they fought for the British, or against,
yes?
Or
no, well, I mean the majority of people who emigrated to the Boer states during the
Gold Rush and Diamond Rush. The common language was just a little bit easier. You know, they're also a little bit selfish in, you know, the way they were seen as foreigners. They were seen as what were they called? Outlanders?
Jutlanders. It's like, yeah. it's a weird word. Microsoft Word doesn't even recognize it, actually. It's like UIT and then Landers after that.
Okay, so you see, the Irish are probably being oppressed nearly worse in being there. I'd say all the nations that were represented in immigrants there were being treated more poorly than the Irish are being treated by the British.
Yeah, there was a lot of sympathy though in Ireland and in among Irishmen themselves, because they sympathised with the struggle of the Boers, who, as far as the Irish were concerned, were struggling against the same imperialism that they were struggling against and had been struggling against for 700 years.
Yes, 700 years. Apparently, as time goes on, that number gets bigger, but I'm convinced it's only because, you know, time is actually passing and...
But there was a lot of sympathy among Irishmen with the Boer struggle.
And I can understand that.
Yeah, of course.
Nationalism was really, really taking off. Mm. Like, you had... What's his name? John Redmond, was it?
Yeah.
He was getting together the Irish nationalists and starting to get the nationalist movement.
It was
going.
It was really starting up at this stage. Okay, the actual campaign of the war, I barely went into it all. Because as you may have noticed, I basically spent the entire time talking about diplomacy, which is my like forte.
Yeah, he loves it.
I absolutely love it, so it's pretty understandable from my point of view. But I know that a lot of you listen to the episodes not just for diplomacy but also for wars themselves.
A bit of bloody bashing.
Yeah. So in my efforts to keep it balanced in the way I approach the episodes, I'd like to go into the wars campaign a bit more now.
I actually think that the actual episode you did there was possibly the best one you've ever done. I found it really engaging, and it stuck to what your objective was, and
good.
Like, I found it really clear and like enlightening. So
thank you.
Good job, man.
Thank you
really
very
good.
Much. I did not pay him to say that. Okay, so the campaign of the Boer War is generally split into three phases. In the first phase, you have the Boers invading and holding completely the initiative. I covered a few of the battles, but not in any real detail.
It was strange. They changed their strategy. Their last strategy was to fight them when they came at them. This one was like a preemptive strike.
Yeah, they took the fight to the British at the start, which did seem to work because they were very successful.
Yeah.
But
that might have also insulted the British to the point of, you know, retaliation until...
Well, the point I really wanted to get across in the last episode on the war is that the British knew that they had to win this, whatever the cost, and it wasn't going to be like the First Boer War, where they could just let it slide and sign a peace treaty. There was the real belief that if they didn't appear strong enough in their colonial areas, that they wouldn't appear strong enough in Europe, especially at a time when Europe was quite volatile in its diplomatic dealings, and it really seemed important to form strong allies and appear strong in everything that you did.
Yeah.
It was very important for the British to actually deal either an extremely decisive blow in this case, or to extinguish the Boer states altogether. And obviously they wanted to extinguish the Boer states because of the nature of those Boer states and where they were.
Now, you were just about starting on the campaign.
I was, phase one was the Boers holding the initiative. Phase two was the British responding by moving in a large amount of troops. And
so this isn't done over like the last one you said lasted 10 weeks of fighting.
Yeah, it
this
lasted.
One
yeah,
must have been a year, because like to ship all of the troops in from all across the globe must have taken at least 6 months.
The war lasted from October 1899 to March 1902, so it was a good bit longer. But if you consider what the British were doing there, basically removing two states from the map, it would, by its nature, take longer.
Removing all of the culture as well.
Yeah.
So taking all of those people and just stripping it back.
Well,
repair.
I mean, it's interesting as well to see the British mindset change once they fought the war the second time, because they knew what to expect as well as just seeing that the stakes were higher, because they were higher the second time. So phase two of the war is largely seen as like, once the British start taking the initiative back from the Boers and moving more troops in themselves, that's seen as phase two. I don't have the names of those battles in my head because I wasn't really focusing on the war itself. But that being said, I do know the direction that the war went.
Yeah.
And I know that there was a stalemate in the years once the British moved the troops in. Before they got a proper handle on the situation, it was very much containing the Boers. And until they contained them, then they were able to actually plan a proper strategy after that. Yeah.
The blockhouses had a lot to do with that.
Yes, they really did. Now, they can't be underestimated. I had no idea what blockhouses even were or what they had to do with it. But I don't want to go too off on a tangent here, but it's very comparable. The strategy is very comparable to what happened in Britain, like, in the 900s, when the Vikings were invading and the British were trying to find ways to counter that invasion. So they built forts everywhere. And obviously they were bigger forts than the blockhouses, but the idea was the same. That if you have forces in every conceivable kind of place that could be attacked, and you can
it'll
move troops quickly
deterrent.
Out of that. Yes, it'll be a deterrent. Because the Boers were not good at besieging stuff, and they were not good at attacking fortified positions. So it was a very good way to counter their strength.
Did they use that against the Irish rebels?
When are you... Like,
well, I suppose we didn't go all out of rebellion. We went one city rebellion. But
yeah.
Well,
the idea is the same, where you had the Pale, where that was fortified, and it was harder for the disorganized Irish to attack such a well-fortified place than if the British were scattered all around the country.
Yeah.
But back to the Boer situation.
Yes.
The idea for the blockhouses came from the first Earl of Roberts. Oh, I can't remember his name now. It was his idea.
Earl Roberts.
Yeah.
The first Earl of Roberts.
Yeah.
That's his name.
Yeah. I don't know how you could become an Earl of Roberts. I'd love to become an Earl of Twombly. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I think that's even better than being knighted, actually. Like, being Sir Twombly. It wouldn't be good as being, like, Earl of Twombly. But anyway.
I don't know, man.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty British.
Yeah.
You better watch yourself.
I know. More death threats than I've already gotten. Okay, so that second phase involved the British deciding to... The decisions were made to build blockhouses and actually take the fight back to the Boers rather than just containing them. Phase three, then, is defined by
Could you give me a description of a blockhouse?
Okay,
like, what exactly
a blockhouse was basically, like, it would be generally a two-story kind of building built out of concrete... Usually, either concrete or well fortified by the kind of materials that they would have had, such as like probably the clay or any of the muck that they would
the
have used. Yeah,
well.
The stone as well. But it would generally be there was a picture of one of them, and it wasn't a very good picture though, so I didn't include it. But it looks like kind of like a treehouse, but made out of stone. If you know what I mean, in the way that it looks kind of makeshift. But it still works, it still does the job.
Right.
They looked kind of like someone had just picked them up and dropped them. Like, it looked like you picked it up out of construction yard and dropped it into the wilderness. But that was the idea, that if you put loads of these things all over the place, even if there's only a handful, because there was only 8 to 10 soldiers in these things, but because they're so well fortified and in such a strong position, they had enough supplies as well to last them a while, so they could stay there indefinitely.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, of course.
Yeah.
But that really changed the nature of the warfare.
Okay.
The blockhouse was a simple structure, but it did the job, and that's all that the British needed. They didn't need any brand new fangled ideas. Like,
obviously this was a tactic used in putting down guerrilla warfare.
Yes, it was.
And it wasn't employed at all in the First World War.
No, not really. I mean, the First World War is completely different in the way that it was fought, because I mean, there was guerrilla warfare, but certainly not to this extent. Once you get to phase three of the conflict, really the only way that the Boers fight is by guerrilla warfare.
Yeah.
Whereas in World War One, it was very static, and it wasn't as fast moving as it was in the Boer War. When I talked about phase two, where they started moving in soldiers...
Yeah. Why weren't the men that were there already adequate?
Well, there's a few reasons for that. The first off is that the British cavalry regiments that were there were nowhere near... on par with the experience that the Boers had, who had been unmounted all their life, pretty much. So in order to combat that, they had to bring in more experienced soldiers from around the Empire, and that's what stands out in the Second Boer War as well. The fact that the British were able to recognise the need to bring in soldiers from around
the
Empire.
How many soldiers in total do you know were actually deployed for this conflict?
Well, on the British side, there were 600,000 soldiers altogether.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah,
and like the population of Boer, like the original population, was about 30,000, I think. I remember.
Yeah, 30,000 actual soldiers that they could field.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's stamps.com, code program.
Powers. And, but because it was a guerrilla war, the British wanted to take absolutely no chances. Yeah. Like, you might not think that it's fair that the British have 600,000 versus 30,000. And of course it's not.
Yeah,
but because of the way that Boers are fighting.
Yeah. And they do have an empire that spans the globe.
And this was, like, I mean, they had used colonial soldiers before, but this was the first time that they had recognised that soldiers around their empire are better at certain things than they are. Bringing in Australian troops, for example, who are far better on horseback than British troops would be, just by nature of the way they live and the way they eke out a living in their homeland.
And like, I'm sure their climate's a little bit.
Yes,
more
it would be
there.
More. It would be similar to what the British to what the South Africans would be used to. So it'd be easier to acclimatise, which is another factor.
Yeah.
So it is important. The Second Boer War is important in that respect because it shows that the British are learning from their past mistakes, and in that they're not treating all their subjects the same. They're recognising that each subject can contribute something different, and they really could.
Yeah.
And another reason that they brought in more troops is because the general state of the British soldiers were very, very was very, very poor. The state of the British soldiers was very, very poor. Because, like, when I was reading about this, I was pretty much taken back in shock, because it said that 40% of the soldiers sent to fight were not of a healthy enough state to actually be fighting in the army. They were a lot of them were malnourished because they came from such poor backgrounds. A lot of them had absolutely no business in the kind of places that they were, because it required more energy than they were capable of exerting.
Yeah.
If you can imagine, like, it seems almost ridiculous, almost as ridiculous as the Crimean War, where I talked about how bad the charge of the Light Brigade was. It'd be almost hilarious if it wasn't so tragic, as I said. And that applies here as well. The British were not treating their home subjects in the same way that in the way that they should be, because they weren't feeding them enough and they weren't giving them enough to sustain them. And
was it a problem with their pay, or were these guys just conscripted, like, just before the combat?
Yeah, well, and it wasn't just conscription, though. A lot of them volunteered because jobs were so hard to come by, especially for the lower classes at this time. And because the lower classes were poorer and had less to eat, because they were less hardy and less suited for this kind of campaign and this kind of war, which was in a very rugged terrain, and it was very fast-moving, unless you were assigned to a blockhouse. But that wasn't necessarily what you were guaranteed to be put at, and even then you'd be moved around a good bit there.
Yeah.
So you needed to have energy, you needed to be strong, you needed to be prepared for the kind of combat that these guys were going into. A lot of them weren't up to it at all, not because it's any fault of their own, just because not only were they not used to it, but their bodies were not prepared for it at all. That's why you have a lot of the Australians and a lot of the New Zealanders and even Canadians were far more hardy and far more, their bodies were just fitter.
They were drawing the elite units from
they were
all
fitter.
The other countries.
They were fitter and they were stronger and they were more able for this kind of thing. It came as a big shock to the British and to the British public that the soldiers were dying of the same diseases that they had died of 50 years before. But that's because, despite the small changes that the British had made in command and stuff, they hadn't made the right ones in respect to their soldiers. The soldiers were still suffering just as badly because they had to
fend. It's not on the same scale as the Crimea.
No, it's not, but it's still considerable enough to warrant some kind of, to warrant a kind of mention in this.
Yeah,
and it
like
was
an outcry from the British public.
Well,
the
British public were absolutely, like, they were aghast that, like, for lack of a better term, that the British soldiers were able to, that the British army was recruiting these men who would absolutely, who were so fragile as it was and were not up to the task of fighting a war because they were so malnourished and were so,
yeah, it just seems very, like,
mismanagement.
Yeah,
it
just
poorly
seems like
done.
It just seems like they needed fodder. So
they needed soldiers.
They got everybody.
Yeah, they needed soldiers quick to fight a war far away, so they conscripted as many as possible. And a lot of the volunteers they took in, because they were so happy to have those volunteers, they didn't really screen them as much as they should have.
Yeah.
And the requirements were often dropped for a few that, especially during the times when they really, really needed them, like in the first few months when things were going badly for the British and they needed soldiers quickly, a lot of the restrictions and requirements were either certainly lowered a lot or they were dropped altogether so that they could get as much men as possible. Because the focus was getting as many men as possible to counter the Boers. Because even if a Boer was more skilled than your soldier who was really malnourished that you were sending over, if you had 10 of those malnourished soldiers against one Boer, you'd have far more of a better chance.
What if the Boer's on a horse?
Well, even if the Boer's on a horse.
Rifle shots.
Yeah, 10 rifle shots. You have 10 chances there. That's a very specific example, obviously. But it just goes to show, like, this is the kind of mindset that the British High Command was in. The knock-on political effects in Britain should be understated as well. In the year 1900, because the war seemed to be going better then and the war was still popular at home, the British public were happy with the Conservative government, and it enjoyed a very high level of popularity and roaringly successful at that stage. As the war progressed badly, and as the British saw the truths of the conflict, such as the concentration camps and the state of the British soldiers, another factor as well, I'll get into a bit afterwards, is that the newspapers were sending reports home in the Boer areas.
They were being brutally honest.
They were being brutally honest because there was free press in Britain, and they were saying the truth. And I know that I said that this was important in the Crimea, but an interesting thing to think of now, there was a higher literacy level in Britain and everywhere in Europe now than there was 50 years before.
Yeah.
So even though the Crimea was the first to see it in a massive scale, the Boer Wars was the first to see it on such a scale that it had more of an impact because more people were able to read it and more people were able to find out what was going on. And then as that happened, more people demanded to know what was going on. They felt it was their right to know what was happening.
And that's when the media became, you know, rulers of Britain.
Yeah, they became their own power in some respects. And the British government knew they had to appease the media just as much as the public so that the media would say what they wanted them to say so that the public would hear this and be influenced. I mean, that's been done for centuries before and after. But it shouldn't be understated that because of that, the British Conservative Party then, once they suffered such desperate straits in popularity and all the other things that I mentioned, after that they suffered a terrible defeat in the 1906 election.
Okay.
This basically annihilated them from effective opposition for a good few years.
Conservatives are still around, for a few
years. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't mean they disappeared.
Were they in power during the First World War?
During the First World War, they had a coalition government of all the parties.
Okay.
So that there wouldn't be kind of opposition to kind of unite the country for the common cause.
Of course, yeah.
But certainly the Conservatives suffered badly in the years leading up to the war. And there's often speculation because what if one government did this or one government did that? The opposition that was in power then, instead of the Conservatives, took a different line to Germany than maybe the Conservatives would have.
Yeah, and certainly, the Conservatives might have maintained that relationship.
Yeah, and with respect to Ireland as well, an issue closer to our hearts, if the Liberal government that took over from the Conservatives wasn't there, or if they had taken a harder line against Ireland, would the rebellion have broken out as it did, or would it have been suppressed at all, or would it have been considered as a sign that Britain needed to change its policy towards Ireland? I mean, who's to say that it would be or wouldn't be, based on who was in power at the time? But once World War One broke out, it was irrelevant anyway, because all the parties were in power at that stage in a grand coalition.
Do you know the way the Boer, right?
Yes.
The Boer is like these Dutch immigrants from like third generation, probably. Why didn't the Netherlands step in? Why was it Germany and France that were playing big daddy for the Boer states?
That is a good question, and I would have liked to have focused more on the Netherlands if I had had time. I'm going to do that now, obviously. But the reason why I focused more on Germany and France was because of the circumstances of the time. The Netherlands wasn't really an entity in Europe at this time, and it wouldn't be in World War One either, because it would be neutral, and unlike in World War Two, Germany respected its neutrality.
Okay.
So it didn't really get considered into the political equation. But the attitude of the Netherlands during this time, Queen Wilhelmina, is that how you say it? Oh, all right. Learning something new every day. The approach taken by her and her government was completely to ignore the South African blockade that the British were doing at this stage. The Netherlands saw what the British were doing to the Boers, but because, like, obviously Britain is a lot more powerful than the Netherlands, they can't exactly declare war or anything like that. But there was a lot of sympathy, not just in the Netherlands, but in all of Europe, for what the Boers were doing and for their struggle against British imperialism. And it was seen as imperialism. It wasn't seen. The war against the Boers was not seen as a good thing in many parts of Europe.
Yeah.
It was seen as a bad thing. And the support was definitely there more so for the Boers than for
the
British.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and there is a few reasons for that, because it's a really racist time. I mean, because it was white against white and not white against black, if the Boers had been black, say, there would have been a very different opinion, because it would have been seen as the white man's burden, and, oh, the British have every right to beat down the Boers, what are the Boers doing, get rid of them kind of thing. But because the Boers were white and they'd been there for some time, it was considered their land.
They were of European descent.
They were of European ancestry, and that really does come into it. I mean, because the Boers had been there as well, and they had been seen as the kind of liberators of that area, they were taking over and they were bringing civilization to that area, and now the British were coming in and trying to kick the Boers out. And the Europeans were saying, oh, what are you doing? The Boers brought civilization to that area.
Yeah.
They were doing the right thing already. What are you coming in for and kicking them
I
out?
I think possibly the worst thing that could have happened for the free states there, the Boer states, was finding natural resources.
Yeah, definitely.
That possibly was the worst possible scenario for them, because the British could have just left them. They weren't becoming like big. They weren't attracting massive immigrants.
No,
they,
not at all.
They were just, you know, Britain would have been contentious to have left them.
Mm.
But then the discovery of precious minerals in both that province.
That put the nail in the coffin, absolutely.
That was it. Britain had to take it or it would look weak. And I don't know. It's just a very strange mindset in my
mind. It is. I mean, it's that's something so positive, like the discovery of gold could be such a bad, bad thing for all parties involved, really. I mean, Britain won, but it had to learn a lot of harsh lessons from this war, as it would from all
subsequent
wars.
Surely, at the time, wasn't it the gold mines were being exhausted?
Well, by the time the Boer War came about, the gold mines were certainly suffering because the gold seemed to be drying up. Actually, it was only after the Boer states were absorbed that more effective ways of harvesting the gold were found, and then the production of gold and the extraction of it started to pick up a bit. But that's not to say that it was a good thing that it got taken over. I mean, certainly, if you ask any Boer, would they rather be independent states or have more effective ways to harvest the gold? They would have chosen the former.
Yeah.
So
now the Boers' actual attitude to more immigrants was absolutely preposterous.
Yeah.
I think, like, you're of European descent, you embrace Europeans that come. You join them to your culture so that there's a definite form of nationality to them.
Yeah.
Like, if you go to the Boer, you become a Boer.
Mm.
It's not... Instead, they said, you come to the Boer, you become an Uitlander.
Mm.
And that's it. You stay an Uitlander,
yeah.
no matter how long you stay here.
Yeah.
Like, you be a descendant of an Uitlander.
Mm.
And I think that sort of racism
towards
basically their cousins was really, it was their own downfall.
Yeah.
They could have easily have unified these people coming in to their cause, and even the corporations, the mining corporations, had they could have brought them under so that they weren't looking to the British to help them out.
Yeah.
They could have been like, okay, we'll let you off with your taxes because, you know, we need you guys here to keep the jobs going, to keep the taxes coming in.
Of course. Well, because the Boers, you see, the Boers were very, they had a very strong sense of nationalism.
They had a very small-minded sense of, like,
they didn't have a big picture
at all.
No.
Had they seen what they could have done, like, what would have happened had they realized? They would have become a nation of, what, 90,000 people? And they would have been unified and strong, and the British wouldn't have been able to march in there.
Yeah, but you see, the fear was that those new people that had come in brought with them ideas about the Boer states that were different to what the Boers there already had.
Okay.
Like, the ideas that, oh, why can't we all just get along, might seem, like, reasonable to us, but because let's all get along involved, for the large part, they involved unifying, because the people who were coming from Europe didn't understand that the Boers wanted to stay independent, because they couldn't see the difference between the Boer states or from the Cape Colony. I mean, they're both white countries, they're both inhabited by white men, and they use African labour and their European ancestry, so what's the big deal? But the mindset of the Boers, it's hard to pinpoint exactly, but it really does come down to us versus them in the Boer mindset, because they viewed themselves as different, and they viewed themselves as pioneers, because they were the first ones there.
Yeah.
And who has the right to come here and tell us what we can and can't do? Who has the right to come here and change our policy?
Like, illegalize, what was it, the Uitlanders? Like, Uitlanders probably wouldn't have come up with their own party had they been allowed to choose between the parties that were already there. And like, it just seems like from the start, the Boers were trying to isolate and alienate the immigrants that were coming in. That gave Britain the excuse to come in as, again, the noble hand and liberate these people.
Well, they were shooting themselves in the foot, and really they should have planned it better, because they would have known that like experience has shown throughout the world that once you discover gold, people are going to move in and try and exploit that gold, whether you want them to or not. They're going to settle down, and that's going to change the demographics of the population. They should have prepared for that, and they should have learned from examples elsewhere in the world.
Yeah. Now, who's to say? This is all speculation.
Yeah.
Had they won?
Yeah.
Like, what would have happened? Would the British have continued to pile soldiers in, and had it been procrastinated all the way out to 1914, would Britain have even been ready for another war?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if the Jutlanders and the Boers had been able to settle their differences properly and had been able to join forces together, I mean, I myself...
But the First Boer War wouldn't have happened. Like, they wouldn't have gone in trying to start a rebellion.
Yeah.
And the British would have come in force the first time.
Yeah. I mean, well, that is true. But don't forget, gold was only discovered in 1886.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So that was the big deal. I mean, diamonds was pretty big in 1867, but gold was the real thing. Gold drove Europeans crazy, because the sight of gold, like, suggested so many things. Like, the dream of wealth and the dream of starting afresh somewhere else, it really can't be underestimated. And it just goes to show how much people believe in that. Because in the space of only a few years, 60,000 people came over from all over Europe and the United States, which was only starting up itself really around this time, to start a new life. I mean, it's fascinating, really, to think that so many people would uproot themselves to try and start again at the promise of gold, but that's what so many of them did. And because their way of life was in many ways different, don't forget, a lot of the Boers, they had a different mindset spiritually as well, because a lot of them were Puritans, or they would have been Quakers, or they would have been trying to start anew with their own ideas that they had. I mean, you might think, why would you move all the way to South Africa and start a colony? If you are not being given the respect you want at home, you might think, well, there's better stuff out for me out there. Right. And once you get out there, if people out there share your own ideas, suddenly your ideas...
You're in paradise.
Yeah, so. You're in paradise then. And not only that, but if you can find people that agree with you in this new area, then suddenly although you were the minority in your old country, now you're the monopoly in your new country, and you don't want to give that up if people from your old country then come to your new country and say, oh, we want to have our rights and everything. Of course you're not going to let them do that.
Yeah.
Because that means that you'll have to go back to the old ways.
Yeah.
If any of that makes sense.
No, it made sense. It's just like, if you have lost his meaning, go back about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Because that's where he actually starts the point.
Yeah. I realize sometimes, because I just made that. I'm flying by the seat of my pants during all these episodes. So
that's a good expression.
It's one of my favorite expressions. And I really do live by it, especially in these episodes. But I think often it's the best way to be.
Yeah,
because
if it's too long, Zach will just cut it back. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
I make myself look very smart in these episodes.
He gets rid of all this. He checks it afterwards to see if it's actually true.
Okay, what else do I have to talk about?
I suppose the Berlin Conference. Oh, yeah. No, Paul. Talk about Paul.
I want to talk a bit about Paul Kruger. Yeah. You can't really underestimate the impact he had. I said he was basically the permanent president of the Transvaal, or the South African Republic, during this time, and that
was he a dictator? Because it would seem by the policies he adopted, it was very much like a dictator.
Yeah, you see, I'm going to be honest, I don't know the exact nature of Transvaal politics, but because it was a republic, they had a president, and that president was Paul Kruger for a very long period of time.
You mean like the way North Korea had a president?
Well, no, not so much that. Like, it wasn't nearly along that kind of a level. Don't forget, he was very popular as well.
Okay.
Because he was always doing stuff. He was always doing stuff to support the independence of his country.
Yeah.
He'd secured many deals, and he'd been very, very visible during the First Boer War as well, where he'd been part of the Boer delegation to sign the peace treaty.
Yeah.
So he was fiercely independent, and he was deeply religious, and he was basically a stereotype of a Boer settler, because he had all those things that were expected of the Boers. Like, they were God-fearing men, they were very hard-working, they were very ruralized, and their horses were very important to them. Like, that's basically what he was. That was him in a nutshell. So he was very suited to the position of president and for representing the country as long as he did. He's a very important figure, obviously. I mean, you could say he started the Second Boer War, but really, I mean, if he hadn't started it, someone else would have started it. It was only a matter of time.
And he managed to actually get out of the Transvaal.
He did, yeah. After the war, it's kind of sad, really. After the war, he was so upset. His wife died during the war, And while after she had died, he realized there was nothing in the Boer state for him anymore.
I thought it was the Dutch ship. It's a Dutch warship that just ignored the British blockade. Picked him up, but his wife was too sick to travel with him.
Yeah, his wife was too sick.
She actually stayed.
She stayed in the Boer states. Yeah, while he was going over to sign the peace treaty, is what it was.
Yeah.
While he was going over, his wife stayed behind, and of course she died because she was so unwell. I'm not sure what she died of, but she died sometime in 1901, and the year after then, Paul Kruger was very much depressed and upset about the situation, and of course the fact that he lost his wife.
Yeah.
So he decided to stay in the Netherlands instead of going back to South Africa.
Yeah.
And of course this isn't a good thing for the Boer states, because they very much appreciated his contribution, even though it wasn't successful. They had a strong leader in Paul Kruger. But he stayed in the Netherlands. He died 1906, I think it was.
Yeah, at least he didn't see the first war.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's one last thing I want to get into. I mean, I did talk about it a good bit in the actual episode. I spent a long time on it, but the Berlin Conference, just because I kind of want to end on this, because it's a good note of what's to come in Europe.
Yeah.
The fact that Bismarck took it upon himself to organize this is quite impressive. It came down to the Belgian king as well, Leopold II. And this was very much this all centered around the Congo, which if you look at that image I posted on Facebook, it shows that the Belgians owned that, and a lot of things, because Congo is in the center of Africa, a lot of things flowed through there. The Belgian king wanted free trade there. A few of the others didn't want free trade there, so there was a bit of tension going on. To solve this tension, and because Italy was getting upset, Bismarck decided that he was going to organize all these countries into a conference where everyone would have a say, and everyone would have to respect the decisions of that conference.
Yeah, it's sort of like United Nations of the Americas.
It is, yeah.
Make. Oh, no, what was it? The League of Nations.
League of Nations,
trying to envision.
Except,
you can just see, you know, smart people like Bismarck, you know, they've got this way before it becomes
tuition. Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's for more selfish reasons. It's almost unbelievable to think that the nations of Europe carve up the African continent in its entirety, apart from Ethiopia. But that's exactly what they did.
And the conference was important because it basically gave the formula for how delegations about matters concerning Africa and then later concerning Europe would be dealt with.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, yeah. Because later on you'll see crises in, say, Morocco is pretty big ones, and Algeria, where the French and the British are arguing. The French and the British and the Germans are arguing about who owns what. But this conference here, pretty much the blueprint of what's to come.
Yeah. That was a really good talk episode. I really enjoyed that. Remember, guys, be fit.
Yes,
so,
be fit.
And especially the Facebook page, because we'll have the bants on there.
We will.
They're not a form of drugs. They are just the lols, which are also not a form of drugs.
It's just the cocks. Oh, yeah, the crack. Which
is,
crack. That
which
sounds
is,
even more
which
like
is
a drug.
Not a form of drugs. It's just, you know, the fun. There you go.
We're having the fun.
We're having the fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that being said, we shall take our leave. I'm Zach.
I'm Sean.
And you've been listening to When Diplomacy Fails podcast.
Thanks.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, Code Program.